And the role of the church is supposed to be liberating and not a gatekeeper to hell on earth. And those are ways in which I can define and talk about both the text that we read from beginning to end. And so the white church has a responsibility to release its whiteness and its supremacy in order to live out God's demand for justice for all.
Welcome to another edition of Res Cov's Letters to the Church, a series in which we are making space to hear from people across the church, that vast communion of saints, as we sometimes say, as they share their thoughts with us on faith and life and the church. And today we're really excited to welcome Reverend Dr. Velda Love. Velda is serving as the Minister of Racial Justice in the United Church of Christ. And prior to coming to that role, she was an adjunct professor at North Park Theological Seminary, where she taught Sankofa and racial righteousness and reconciliation. And she also served at North Park University as the Director of Intercultural Justice and Learning for 16 years. And I think beyond all of this, one of the reasons Dave and I are excited to connect with Velda is because we actually overlapped a couple years at least in seminary together. And so it's so great to get reconnected with you, Velda. And thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you, Aaron. And thank you, Dave, for the invitation to be with you and to have this very important conversation.
Definitely, definitely. So we always begin these conversations with a kind of get to know you question for our people who may not be as familiar with our guests. And that question is, what shapes and informs how you show up in the world?
That's a great question, and one I often address in my role as the Minister of Racial Justice, but I show up in my body, and my body is as a woman of African descent. And that shapes my identity because my ancestors are from the continent, the cradle of civilization, God's first people on that continent. I show up because my DNA survived the Middle Passage. I show up as a woman of African descent, born and raised and socialized on native soil that was colonized by settler colonialism. And I show up in that way because that is part of my education, my understanding, and the way in which I inform people that I'm not a minority, that God did not create minorities or superior people groups. And so when I show up fully, both in the divinity of God's intention for my body and the way in which I show up because I've done the work to be here.
As you were talking, I kept thinking about, like, you laid out this historical narrative, and that's powerful. And I as you were talking, I kept thinking about the role of the church in that narrative. And I wonder if you have, I'm sure you have some thoughts on that, but I'm wondering if you'd be willing to kind of say a little bit about that. And I think that when I say the church, there's obviously lots of different aspects of that. And so I think I'm talking about specifically the white church.
The role of the white church is an institution, and institutions perpetuate itself. And so when you are looking at white church, you're looking at white Christian supremacy, and you're looking at white supremacy in particular. And the role of the church is supposed to be liberating and not a gatekeeper to hell on earth. And those are ways in which I can define and talk about both the text that we read from beginning to end. And so the white church has a responsibility to release its whiteness and its supremacy in order to live out God's demand for justice for all. And if you've listened to the rhetoric over the years, it is tearing our nation apart, but it is also either undergirding our churches or it is giving pause to what the church should really be. And that is on the forefront of addressing the empire within the United States and also being an active voice in global demonstrations where the church should be actively moving beyond places of comfort and social hour to really digging into activism because you cannot have redemption if you've done no work to eradicate the systems and institutions and structures that keep people hungry, caged, incarcerated, drinking tainted water. If you're not looking at the policies that were created to undergird and keep out people of African descent, especially Black communities, brown communities, from voting, from being redlined and not having access to communities. We have moved forward, but we also move back when the white church, is not interested in liberation and freedom and justice for all.
In one of the things as we've been talking that keeps coming up in my mind is the importance of the stories we tell and the myths we create. You've mentioned that a few times. So I'm wondering, because that can be a double-edged sword, right? These stories can be one of empowerment from our ancestors, or they can be these kind of myths like American exceptionalism, doctrine of discovery. How do you think we do that work of deconstructing some of these stories to tell better stories, truer stories?
All of our stories are complicated. They're not just happy ever after stories. There's inner conflict. There is occupation conflict. There are political conflicts. So we are fraught with conflicts, both internal and external. Bryan Stevenson, who is the founder and the president of Equal Justice Initiative, always says in many of his remarks that we can't heal as a nation if we do not change the narrative. Meaning we can't heal from this mark of the enslaved if we keep talking about people of African descent as being inferior or immigrants as being illegal. If you're a person of faith and you're a Christian, you cannot call God's people aliens. And you cannot look at your siblings in Christ or those that God created and sit in judgment as if you have the authority to leave out people you disagree with or don't look like. Those are the implications, and those are the stories that need to be told, the complicated stories, as well as the conquering story. But until the lion tells the story and not the hunter, we will not have accurate narratives to tell.
One of the other things that Bryan Stevenson says that I find so important is the power of proximity, and the importance of proximity. And it feels we've just come through this election, and we're sitting in the midst of it still, like today, unresolved. And it feels that one of the struggles that we have is that we are not proximate enough to even hear these stories that you're talking about that are so important for us to hear. I don't know that I necessarily have a question in there. Maybe it's like, how do we become more proximate to one another or to,
I've heard him say that. I heard him speak when I was still in Chicago at Evanston High School, and he talked about proximity. I guess my challenge around proximity is, if you don't change your language, if you haven't done your work, being close to me as a woman of African descent does not change how you've been socialized. If you believe that you are of a particular dominant culture or dominant history or dominant language, then I have to step back and say, you are not dominant anything, because God did not create dominant cultures, peoples, or histories, right? So if your socialization doesn't change, if the way in which you understand humanity doesn't change, if you are not using language that creates equity and justice, if that doesn't change, we can walk side by side, run together, eat together, and maybe even worship together. But if your fundamental heart and your re-education around who people groups are that are not inferior to Eurocentric ideas and ideologies and Eurocentrism and Anglo-Saxon exceptionalism, if that doesn't change in your thinking, in your behaving, and in the way you feel, we will not be seeing each other eye to eye. We you know, we just won't.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that that's a really, that's a really helpful corrective to the idea that proximity alone is, well, we just need to be closer to one another and hear one another's stories. There's, I'm trying to remember as you were talking, is it George Yancey who has that wonderful phrase about the importance of white people living unsutured? So a willingness to be open and to not, because the fragility, we tend to want to suture that up because it's so uncomfortable. And so what does it look like for some of what I think is, what does it look like for us to live unsutured as white people in that as we get potentially proximate?
You have to be willing to be uncomfortable. I've vetted and certified 9 facilitators that have gone through the African-centered project of Sacred Conversations to End Racism. We are together for a whole year in community, learning together from pre-human existence into the current contemporary society. And it is startling for everyone to go back and do their work and get their history. But it's uncomfortable and it hurts. But if you're a person of European ancestry, there's something lacking in your understanding of suffering. There's also, and I don't mean just personal suffering, I'm talking about corporate suffering, collective suffering. Mm. And so if your ancestors haven't been lynched, murdered because they show up in whatever skin pigmentation they have, if your town, your village, your suburb, if your houses have not been bombed, if your people have not been shot in the street by state-sanctioned violence and white supremacy vigilante acts of violence, you may know, again, hurt or mourning on an individual level, but because this nation was birthed in blood, and violence becomes normative. And we can look at violence and say it doesn't impact me. And so when do people of European descent feel the impact of the pain that has been caused for 500 years plus? If one is not willing to sit in that pain and lament the loss and look at the text that they claim they read or study, when Rachel is weeping for her children and refuses to be consoled, if you are not weeping with Rachel, if you did not extend condolences to those parents of Black bodies that fell to the ground, George Floyd or Ahmaud Arbery or Breonna Taylor or Tamir Rice or Rekia Boyd or any of those out of the LGBTQ community, if there was no sense of solidarity and an ache in your heart, if lynching was in your lifetime and you brushed it off as something that really didn't happen because it wasn't your people, then you don't have any empathy. And you really can't feel the depth of trauma that happens in people's lives who have trauma repeated over and over again. And so the discomfort has to be there. The willingness to hurt has to be there.
Hmm. One of the, I'm really, just based on our conversation even now, I'm really interested in your thoughts on I know in white communities, we often struggle with the intersection of faith mingling with politics. And I have a sense of how you might respond to that. But I'm going to ask the question anyway, because I want you to respond to that.
Okay. I can respond to that. So again, we've read Politics has been part of the fabric of our nation states and our nation. Again, we're not reading. We're not studying our history. Politics and empire have been around before Christ. Occupation and the ways in which people have been extracted are part of our narrative. In our current contemporary lives, we want white Jesus to be blonde and blue-eyed and talk sweetly and allow us to drink our coffee and eat our danishes so that we can go home and feel very comfortable. We do not look at the fact that our nation and nations before the United States was formed operated out of politics, papal edicts, and the papacy was connected to politics. When this nation was formed, it was the government that claimed its ideal as manifest destiny and a city on a hill, and it became political. Politics reside in the laws that come out of both the German and the Roman Empire. Politics is part of the ethos of the people. And if you separate yourself from politics, then you're separating yourself from the very text that we read that is both in the Old and the New Testament. It is monarchy that is set up. It is kings that are set up as rulers. It is Jesus who is executed at the hands of the government and politics through the Roman Empire. And he was used as an example as those who were lynched. If you go against the politics and the government, we will string your body up. We will nail you to a tree, and you will be an example that politics and government will always supersede the needs and the rights of humans, other humans, not like us. Politics is what drives this country. Politics is ingrained in every policy. Policies are created to uphold white supremacy. And if you do not have a clear understanding of that politics is very much married to white supremacy, then you are walking around blind to the ways in which you support the gates of hell.
So you did have some
thoughts. Just a few. A little bit.
So in our, you know, this is called Letters to the Church, and it's kind of this idea of these specific epistles written to particular people at a particular time. So in light of your calling and your vocation, what would be your letter to the church right now? What would you want to say to the church at this moment? Another small question.
Another tiny question. I'll give you a little tiny answer. I have been using Revelations a lot lately. And I would say that my letter would be that in that Revelation 7:9 through the end of the chapter, my letter would be to the church that the intentionality of humanity, and this is the third testament and the epistle from a womanist perspective, is that God had fully intended for humanity to be whole. There are enough resources on the earth to feed and clothe and house. There's enough water if we don't pollute it. There's enough air if we don't pollute that. My epistle would include that there's going to be a family reunion, that when we have that revelation, that awakening, when those scales fall from our eyes, that we will see that God's intentionality is that we are kin, we are family, we are not biologically separated, that we are one people, and that God delights in our diversity and loves a good, the fish that the Swedish eat as well as catfish. And that, you know, God delights in the colors. And so God is not colorblind, because when the sky is blue and the sun is yellow and the grass is green and the flowers are various colors, that delights God. And so why can't we see the very delight in God and the delight in humanity? And then I'm very clear that we are looking at a moment where the beast, the dragon, and the whore coexist. And if the church decides that it wants to align itself with the dragon, that it wants to be the beast, and the whore is the way in which it is greedy and racist and lives in ideologies of white supremacy, I can't say as a human being where the church will end up. But I would rather be on the side of a liberator than a slave to the dragon and the beast, and my institution be considered a whore. To say very little. And I guess, and you know, my letter, it would be a love letter, but it would also be with stern and concrete visuals as well as language that depicts you have a choice and you've chosen. And I tell one of my favorite scriptures is when Jesus tells the disciples to go two by two into the village to drop the word, and those who want it will be receptive, and those who don't, shake the dust off your feet and keep going. Not everyone is going to make the choice to be a liberator, to follow justice, to love humanity, and to seek peace. Not everyone. And that's not really our role. For as long as I have breath in my body, I will do what God has called me to do. And for those who want to be on the journey to undo what has been done, to harm humans, then that's where they sit. I'm a Harriet Tubman all the way. Either you're coming or you're not. But we are moving forward. So,
well, and I think, yeah, that's such a good word. And any authentic and real love letter is going to be honest and true, and sometimes stern and challenging. Velda, this has been a gift for us. And I'm really grateful for your time today, but also grateful for your voice in this today in this community, but also in the church. And it is an encouragement to know that you're at work in the church. And
thank
so
you.
I'm grateful for you, and just want to say thanks again for your time today with our community.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Dave. And thank you, Aaron. And I would just encourage you to lean into the church that's in the streets right now across the globe. That's the church protesting, standing up against the government, young people of every denomination. They're in Palestine. They're in Australia. They're in England. They're in the Auckland's. They're everywhere. That's the church. Fighting for liberation and justice. And if we would just listen to that church in the streets, we will model that church in the first century. We might get martyred. We might not live to see the liberation for all, but at least we've used our lives to the fullness of God's intentionality.
Amen. Amen. Thanks so much, Velda.
Thank you.